Okay, hello everyone. My name is Maggie Paul, and I'm part of an evaluation team at NYU spanning three different schools. I'm at the School of Medicine. My colleague Beth, who's here today, is at the Steinhardt School, and we also have some colleagues at the new College of Global Public Health. I'm here today to present some sort of mid-course findings from an ongoing evaluation of a supportive housing program that's targeted at homeless individuals with high healthcare costs. And I have no relationships to disclose. Okay, so this program is funded by the Corporation for National Community Service. It is a social innovation fund program, and this particular social innovation fund program is being administered and technical assistance is being provided by the Corporation for Supportive Housing. And actually, our last annual meeting was at the California Endowment. So you have lovely facilities in LA. And as I mentioned, our team at New York University is conducting the evaluation of this program. So the program is targeted at homeless men and women with high health care costs, and as such, the program provides permanent supportive housing linked to a range of other services that are needed by this population, with a particular focus on health care services, so primary health care, mental behavioral health care. There are two main program goals one is sort of a given, so it's hard for me to think of it as a goal, but to keep participants in housing, to maintain housing stability, and really the main goal that we're focusing on in our evaluation is to reduce health care costs among this population in the program. So this is a national demonstration project, and there are four main sites: Los Angeles County, San Francisco, Washtenaw County in Michigan, and Connecticut. And both the Los Angeles sites and the Connecticut sites have four sub-sites that really do function sort of as separate entities. So although there's a single program model that unites all of these sites and really drives their program activities, we've found, since the study began in 2012, we've found that there really are major differences across sites. And so that's really why I'm here today, is to talk about some of those differences and ways in which those differences shape the program in each site. I'll be talking about three main areas, so targeting enrollment. Specifically, there were planned differences in sites' targeting strategies, so I'll talk about those and the effects of those. And also, it turns out that the population that they captured through their targeting efforts is quite different across sites, according to some key measures that we've been tracking. I'll also talk about underlying medical needs and availability of services and ways that local policies and even cultural norms affect those measures. And then finally, I'll be talking about how community approach, sort of attitudes towards substance use and philosophical approach to supportive housing has affected the program. We have three main sources of data for our evaluation. We have we developed a survey for participants. They take it at baseline and then at least 1 year after they've been housed. So that's pre-post on the program group. We also have some administrative data that really measures cost and utilization. And then we've been conducting annual site visits. And a lot of what I'm going to talk about today is taken from mainly the survey and annual site visits. And the purpose of the site visits is to really take a deep dive into each of these four sites and get a better sense of what's going on. So we do these annually, and we interview between 20 and 35 people at each site during our visits. Okay, so as I mentioned, this program targeted the same group of people. The goal here was to capture a homeless population with the highest medical costs in the community. So they really went after the highest flyers in their community. They used very different strategies to do that. So three sites used a matched lists approach. In this method, they took some sort of data on healthcare utilization, so Medicaid or hospital data, and matched it with some sort of data source on housing. Usually, actually, I think in all of these three cases, they took shelter use data. And so this strategy worked, but it also missed a population of individuals, specifically individuals who are homeless with high medical care costs, but are not using the local shelter care system. And this is kind of a big deal because on our site visits, you know, we're hearing that actually there could be some really good reasons for this population to not use the shelter system. You know, there's theft in some shelters, there's some violence, depending on which shelter, you know, which community we're talking about. And so, but regardless, in spite of this population that they missed, this strategy really did work to capture the target population. The Los Angeles site, in contrast to the other three sites, used a point-of-care approach. And so they recruited eligible participants at the hospital when they presented for care. This only works with a very large potential population of participants. And so, for example, this would not have been feasible in our Washtenaw County site. The population just isn't large enough to support that sort of passive recruitment strategy. It misses a population that's somewhat different from the match list excluded population. This strategy excludes individuals who are homeless with high healthcare costs but present at hospitals that are not participating in the program in LA County. So again, not you know, a reason to do away with either one of these strategies. They both were successful, but just want to be upfront about what populations were overlooked in each site. So as I mentioned, each site successfully identified their target population, homeless individuals with highest costs in their communities. However, when we took a look at the data on utilization and costs, we see that these populations really do look quite different across sites. In particular, San Francisco and Michigan had very low baseline costs relative to the other sites. And when I say baseline costs, I mean average utilization during the year prior to program enrollment. So just to give you a sense of the differences here, San Francisco had an average baseline cost of around $15,000 per year, whereas Connecticut was more around $40,000 per year. So these are really big differences here. And we think that there are some things about the local environment in San Francisco and Michigan that are really driving these differences. So in San Francisco, we think that the strength of their safety net actually has led to a lower baseline cost. So individuals who are entering the program in San Francisco are much more likely to have been utilizing a lot more community services, you know, in their area relative to other populations, which may have driven down their utilization at baseline. So although they're still the highest cost individuals in their community, they're just not nearly at the level of people in Connecticut or LA. In Michigan, it's a different issue going on. So Michigan was our smallest community in terms of the size of the targeted population. So I know you don't think of Connecticut as a sprawling, you know, metropolis, but actually the sites that participated in Connecticut were spread so far apart. They really are different cities in different counties, and so that greatly expanded the reach of the Connecticut program relative to Michigan. So in Michigan, it really is just Washtenaw County, and so that distribution of healthcare utilization just looks different when the population is that small. So so we think that is really driving the lower baseline costs in that community. You know, our measure of perceived access to care. So this is self-reported access to barriers to healthcare that we captured on our baseline survey. It fits with what we're finding in the cost data. So, and our theories about why that is. So, for example, we see that, you know, San Francisco, only 14% of individuals reported having trouble finding a physician in the year prior to enrollment versus almost 40% in LA. And that sort of fits with our safety net theory. So far we've identified two major areas that we're sort of using to explain barriers to access in these sites. So the first major area is that Medicaid policies vary by state. And in particular, some of their eligibility requirements for Medicaid mental health services have become barriers, obstacles to work around in two sites in particular. In Michigan, participants are ineligible for Medicaid mental health services if they're abusing substances. That's just how their policies are written. So that's clearly a major obstacle for program staff to overcome in that site. In Connecticut, it's a little bit of a different story. So in order to access the full suite of Medicaid mental health services, a participant must be diagnosed with a severe mental health condition. It's thought by many of the case managers across all the different sites in Connecticut that that there are a good number of participants that have traumatic brain injuries, but who are not able to be diagnosed because they're using substances, and you have to go through an extended period of sobriety to be able to be diagnosed with a traumatic brain injury and therefore unlock that suite of Medicaid mental health services. So these are two specific examples of how different Medicaid eligibility requirements are really constricting the level of services that the program is able to provide to their participants in this mental health arena. The second major barrier to care that's come up so far is geography and access to transit. And I'm picking on LA here, but this is really a problem in a different way in every site. All sites are grappling with these issues. So the sprawl in LA has had negative impacts on the program in a couple different ways. The driving time really limits case manager contact hours, and so as you can imagine, clients are not all housed in one neat little neighborhood in LA, and so case managers are driving all over the city to see different clients, and that not only limits their contact hours, but also contributes to burnout. Furthermore, it's challenging for program staff to house clients in areas of the city that they're familiar with and that are conveniently located at things like public transit and groceries. And we know from our site visits, talking with clients, that satisfaction with their neighborhood is it matters a lot. And actually, we've heard stories of people actually returning to the street or returning to some other part of town or just asking to be transferred to a different housing unit because they feel so isolated in this new part of town that they've been placed. So the sprawl is really an issue in LA. Public transit has also emerged as a major cause of delays to care. And it's not really fair. This isn't picking on LA because they have a mental health provider that is very engaged with the Medicaid mental health population there, so that's a big plus. But the difficulty, the challenge is that this provider in particular is located in a part of the city that's actually quite difficult to reach via public transit, and so clients either never want to make an appointment because it's so far away or end up missing appointments, and so that's been an issue in that one particular site. And then the last area that I'd like to talk about in terms of local context really mattering is around community values and philosophies and shaping program, specifically around substance use and treatment. So in Michigan, shockingly, Housing First is a brand new approach. So with this SIF program, this is the first Housing First program that Washtenaw County, Michigan has had. And it's been a challenge. The program staff in that site have had a real, obstacle to overcome in getting other service providers to engage with their client population. And so, and they haven't solved all the problems. So abstinence-only treatment programs still predominantly exist in that community. There's absolutely not one medical detox center in Washtenaw County as of our last site visit, And there's a medical detox in a neighboring county, but then that goes back to all of the transportation issues that we've discussed. So clients don't want to, leave their home to go do this. Most of the clients in Michigan have been to treatment, have been to one of these abstinence-only programs, have relapsed, and 30% of the population who took our program population in Michigan is extremely bothered by their drug use. So, which is much, much more than other sites. So there's a lot of psychological issues for clients around their substance use, but then there aren't suitable treatment programs available in the community. In San Francisco, it's not the opposite problem, but it's a much different problem in that they have a harm reduction model that is very firmly in place. And so although they're happy, the program staff are ready and able to provide appropriate sources of care, of treatment programs to clients, it's absolutely not a program goal to get clients to stop using, which is just a much different philosophical approach to other sites, and it's also correlated with a relatively low proportion of clients seeking treatment in that site. Okay, so all of these findings together sort of highlight the difficulty of unrolling a coherent national program model. And that it's not just true of supportive housing programs. It covers many different, it's relevant to many different topic areas. But the local context really does matter. And although our sites are really working hard to change, especially in sites like Michigan, really working hard to change local norms and open up pathways to providing better access to services for their clients, there's still a lot of barriers that will not be overcome during the time frame of this demonstration project. So we absolutely have to account for them in our evaluation. And so where we're at now is we're just starting to get our follow-up, our first wave of follow-up surveys back, so we'll be looking at a lot of indicators of client well-being and drug use and all of those things, access to care 1 year after being involved in the program. So we'll get a sense of how things are working and how they're working differently across sites. And we're also about to begin, I think this February we'll start our final round of site visits to investigate some of these issues on a deeper level. And that's it. Here's my email if you have any questions, and I'm happy to stick around and talk to people. Thank you.
Are there questions for any?
We don't have a moderator.
Yeah, we don't have a moderator. Do
you want to come up, please? No, Chair. I'm
trying to get participation. We are lucky in the way that implementation is occurring because we have these anchor contacts who can help get the word out to their performing providers that this survey is coming, people are going to be calling, so people sort of have a heads up that we were going to be contacting them. And I will say, with few exceptions, people were very thoughtful about some of these questions. And I don't know why necessarily, except that they want to highlight the good work that they're doing. But we have some hospital systems in some of the urban areas in Texas that had, 6 and 8 participating hospitals. And they might have the same representative for, completing the survey. And so, I spent 4 hours on the phone with some of the representatives of these organizations. That's particularly true in some of the community mental health centers who deliver services in multiple regions. So they were lucky enough to get to do this survey for maybe 4 times for different regions. And so I think I think for a lot of organizations, this is the first time they have been asked about these kinds of things, and they've worked really hard to generate and maintain some of these partnerships, and so it was a nice way for them to tell us about what they were doing and for us to document that. But it took, in some of the regions, a lot of emails and a lot of phone calls. And we had some people just straight up. Sure.
I have a question.
Like,
and it depends on the actual I'll do. So I'm very empathetic to the difficulty of evaluating and helps to change systems because I'm trying to do it. It's really hard to measure. And it's interesting to me that the work on this TIP project takes place in Connecticut and in Los Angeles, and here we have these efforts to do this. And all of your work sort of tends towards the left side of the theory of change, right? And kind of early, so you see more density, and people talk to each other, and they have agreements, and MOUs, and things like that. And yet, on the ground, everybody's still struggling. It's really hard to connect shelter data, to help people with aging data, to identify people, all that. And so I'm wondering, is there some way of trying to vision what, I imagine this can take time, but in any of your cases, you know, what would be, from your perspective, as evidence that these things really matter in the end? Like, what would you expect it to look like in 2 or 3 years that would really change the nature of the work rather than right now the kind of level of communication and engagement? Mm-hmm.
I'm trying to think of a specific example. So it doesn't have to be with the health and health policy case study, but in terms of, you know, the foundation trying to convene and have people work together and sharing information. I believe, is anybody here from Fresno? Okay, well, I believe it was the last year, last December, right before, the holiday, the county program for in covering like our safety net, it's the medically indigenous county program, they were going to, because of APA, they decided that they were going to just shut down and stop offering health care for people who are undocumented or people who didn't have other sources of care. And one of our partners heard, called others, and a whole bunch of people came together and just inundated their representative's office with calls and messages. And ultimately what happened was they saved this program. It was not cut, and they actually changed it, so they more specifically are providing healthcare services for all folks in Fresno, regardless of documentation status. So, you know, that's a real example, I think, of where some of these different efforts have converged, and we've seen some, you know, policy changes there. And then that's shared, you know, we're looking at similar efforts in different counties throughout California for that access to care.
I would say that it's probably looking at some of the indicators or evidence would be looking at whether or not people are, A, the simplest one, enrolled in some sort of health exchange. So, for example, in Connecticut, one of the grantees worked to ensure that the website for the state exchange actually was translated into Spanish. And so I think whether or not that made a difference would be to disaggregate the data for people who enrolled in the state exchange and to see if you actually see increases in Spanish-speaking enrollees. That would be an example. I think others, it will take longer to do. I mean, integration of behavioral health and oral health takes a while, and so in the end, to see if there is a difference in those target populations in whether or not, you know, rates of diabetes, hypertension, prenatal care, all of that, you know, change in response to that. So I think it's looking at it further down, but it's hard because there's so many factors that then contribute to that, and a foundation alone is just 1/4 of change.
So I'll say from our Texas Medicaid OS15 experience. So what I presented today is really one small piece of our evaluation, which is much larger. So the state is evaluating the expansion of Medicaid managed care. Our research team is evaluating implementation of some of these specific district projects. We are also looking at changes in trends in uncompensated care, because the waiver shifted from the old model, the PPL model, and the specific care pool of dollars. And then we also looked at stakeholder perceptions of all of this. So ultimately, with all of these data, we would like to link some of these outcomes, more kind of patient-level outcomes that are being measured in the case study, and cost-related outcomes that are being measured in uncompensated care, and our network characteristics might be used as predictors of some of those changes. And so the providers themselves are also reporting all sorts of things to the state that are measurable outcomes that they've been documenting over time. So I think, you know, these sort of multi-level mixed methods approaches can really help to address some of those questions that you raised. But it's intensive and it's costly.
Hi, my name is Minji. I'm also a district project coordinator at New York State. We just started D101 and thank you also for attention on D101. And starting to form this collaboration with a lot of the networking of our providers. So I'm curious if you're trying to see I see a lot of wide range of collaborators between regions. So I'm curious if you're trying to see any specific things that they did for the high performing regions, what they did in terms of
so that's what we're starting to really look at, and we're kind of waiting for some of the third round of data to come in. But we will be doing comparisons, looking at governance structure, for example, how an RHP was organized and governed over time. We're going to be looking at kind of rural-urban differences and sort of the spread of organization. So, for example, I didn't show y'all a map, but in the Panhandle of Texas, it's one region, it's huge. There are a ton of providers in there, so it's really geographically spread out. There are two urban hubs, and everybody else is rural. And so we would talk to individuals on the phone, and they would say, well, would you ever want to work with this organization? Why? To way up at the very top by Oklahoma, and they're like, well, yeah, theoretically, that sounds great. But we would never practically work with them. They're outside of our rural region. We don't even ever see them at meetings. You know, it's not really practical. And so we're going to be looking at some of the sort of geographic and governance type factors and how it influenced network outcomes. Yeah.
Hi, Kelly Ashcraft from International for Health, Regional Health Foundation Integrated Settings Society, which is for foundation on this panel. You shared a lot of great findings about your capacity building work and systems evaluation, something I'm very interested in. And I'm wondering about your learning mechanisms within your foundation. So how do you take what you've learned from this and then feed it back into your capacity building program, et cetera?
Good question. How much time do we have? I'll try to read this. So the California Endowment, we have a learning and evaluation framework. So it includes looking at those drivers of change, the capacity building mechanisms. It includes some evaluation around our three campaigns and high-level goals and priorities around those campaigns. It includes organizational learning, and then it includes local site learning, because we're doing place-based work, so we have 14 sites, and there's a local learning and evaluation team in each of those 14 sites. So we convene them, the foundation, we convene them together. And what we've done over 5 years, I guess, we've worked with them to develop some tools that there's been agreement that all sites would use, so we call it our cross-site learning and evaluation system. And those, not coincidentally, coincide with the drivers of change. So we have some tools that we've developed on collaboration, on policy, on resident-driven organizing, and youth development, and then we have an annual reporting template. So we're able to lift up some of the learning and evaluation at the local level in this cross-site way. And then in addition, for the statewide work, we have more intense learning and evaluation around our prevention team, which is from the Affordable Care Act implementation. We're doing a lot of support there in the state of California. And then there are also some evaluation efforts with the other campaigns. So one of the things that I guess we've done that might be helpful is we've, throughout the organization, developed what we call our 2020 goals, and eventually there'll be 2030 goals, et cetera. And so those have taken highlights from the different program areas and the capacities and the policy wins, et cetera, that we're looking towards, and we look at those every year and try to report on those, and that's part of the CEO's performance review, actually. And in addition to that, there's a lot of like storytelling and video and other types of documentation that isn't under the evaluation, but it really tells the story and shows some of the changes that are going on.
So with the Connecticut Health Foundation, which is a smaller foundation relatively to, relative to California Endowment, what we do is we take that wheel that was shown in the front, on the first slide, and basically hold that up so that we can look at the findings against that and facilitate a discussion basically with program staff to see if like grant making and any other kind of supports in the future actually reflect those strategies and those outcomes they're trying to achieve, because on a day-to-day basis it's easy to lose that. And so being able to remind everybody that here's what you've achieved so far, is it reflecting this, and then how do you move on from there? I'm going to turn to the Connecticut Health Foundation staff and see if Tiffany, who's here, who's the vice president, to see if she has anything she wants to add.
I think the biggest component about the evaluation is that it gave us an opportunity to determine what we really needed to stop doing, slow down and evaluate and keep doing. So we recognized that we were doing a great job with some of our influence at getting at statewide tables and doing a great job with our collaborations with statewide initiatives. Where we weren't really being successful at was in our leadership program, for example. So that gave us an opportunity to stop and redesign our leadership program. Related to the wheel and the grant making, we really do hold that up, and we really try to determine, are we moving the needle with our work? And if we're not, what do we need to shift and what do we need to change? One area that we really are looking at is not just the work that we are doing for communities of color, because we are focused on people of color and health equity for people of color, but also the organizations that we're funding, whether or not they're diverse, whether or not they truly are representing the communities that we most care about. So the evaluation basically gives us a mirror and a snapshot, and we use that in our operating plan, and we will be doing strategic planning next year, and that evaluation that we will receive, this that we have received in the new one in 2016, will inform all of that process.
Any other questions?
Thank you.
Thank you.